oh, 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 O'Reilly.
Check engine, ABS, or maintenance light on? Take the guesswork out of your warning lights with O'Reilly Veriscan. The service is free and provides a report with solutions verified by ASE-certified master technicians. And if you need help, we could recommend a shop for you. Ask for O'Reilly Veriscan today.
Oh, 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 O'Reilly Auto Parts.
Lowe's knows that saving is always top of mind, especially this season. That's why we've picked some great deals for early Black Friday. Get free select DeWalt, Kobalt, or Craftsman tools when you buy a select battery or combo kit. More tools? Why not? Plus, we've got select pre-lit artificial Christmas trees starting at $59.98 because it's never too early to think Christmas. Get Black Friday prices without the crowds. Lowe's, we help. You save. While supplies last, selection varies by location.
It's the Fri-Yay Cocktail with Anna Gleminski.
Right now we have on the line, I'm joined by Lisa Bailey. If you heard the roundup just before the break, you'd know exactly what this is about. And it's about piecing together skulls, which maybe sounds very morbid, but I also think it's got a very important role to play. And it's just maybe something very creative. I don't know. Let's find out. Hello, Lisa. How are you?
I'm great. How are you?
Yeah, really good.
Thanks.
Really looking forward to talking to you. Your book is called Clay and Bones. So that gives me an idea of something that you're doing with your hands. You're modeling something, you're creating something. And of course, we do know that it's all about the skull with you. How on earth did you get into this, this line of work?
Like every other forensic artist, sort of by accident, it just sort of happened with the progression of this, where my life led me, from the military to having a clearance to getting a degree in art. And then there was, oddly enough, this was many years ago, there was actually just an ad in the Washington Post for an artist illustrator at the FBI. And it wasn't starting working on skulls. That's something you have to work your way into. So I applied, and I was more shocked than anyone when I got it. I wasn't even sure it was a real position. Sometimes, I'm just saying, sometimes the government will post positions that are already filled for legal reasons. So, you know, they might already have somebody in mind, you know, but that wasn't the case. This was a junior position. So I started sort of at the bottom rung as an artist and then became what they call a visual information specialist. And wow. As soon as I saw, well, I'll tell you what, when my boss was giving me a tour of the unit, he pointed to a locker and he said, "Oh, that's where we keep the skulls." And I was like, "Wait a minute," you know, and he, actual skulls. And I said, "Well, you need to tell me everything." And as soon as I found out about forensic facial approximation, just that was my life's mission, is to learn how to do it and make that my job. And it was. I loved it.
I mean, they're different skill sets, though, I imagine, illustrating faces as opposed to making a 3D structure, you know, a clay structure, yes, as you were saying. So, you know, you had this goal in mind that you wanted to work with the skulls, you wanted to get into that modeling, but I suppose you were drawing at the beginning. So is this something that you worked on in your spare time to grow a skill set to go in one direction?
I had never sculpted before the FBI, but I should point out that when we first facial approximation used to be due 2D. So it was a drawing over a photograph of the skull.
Wow.
And then when we got a 3D printer, we were able to print a copy of the skull. And that's when we did them in 3D, which is a method I much prefer. I just think you get a more natural feel for the face. It's like when you start applying the clay and you're using your knowledge of facial anatomy, and you have guides for tissue depths, and you have some of the anthropological information, it's almost like the face just sort of happens, because your skull is a structure for your face. And That's why we all look different. It all starts with your bone structure.
And it's pretty important stuff that you're working on. Obviously, it's about identifying people who aren't able to be identified. Do you remember maybe your first job or at some point when you realized the importance of what you were doing and perhaps of getting it right? If you're an artist before, there's a lot of self-expression. But all of a sudden you're doing a job that's for somebody else, you know, potentially to find criminals or to give peace to a family or something like that. So you must have felt a pressure to have to get it as right as possible.
That is exactly right. The big thing with forensic art is there is no self-expression. There's a little bit of a gray area because we don't know everything specifically about the face. But yes, you don't put, there's no personal touch there. I mean, I have a different sculpting style than other artists, but absolutely there's no self-expression. This is a piece of forensic work. It's there to serve a purpose. It's to hopefully spark memory in someone that knew that person, because the reason a skull gets to us in the first place is that the databases, you know, DNA on one hand and missing persons on the other, it's not in the missing person database. So many of these people are never reported missing. And just for numerous reasons, maybe it was a runaway or family trouble or whatever. And so many times there's been a cousin that says, I don't know whatever happened to him. Like, and they start looking around and realize that they were never reported missing. And that right there can help solve it. Wow. I mean, I've had cases where the sculpture has been in a database for years. And then it's the moment somebody goes, well, I'm going to report, they've been missing for 20 years, they've never been reported missing, then they get in the system, then that's can be a cold hit in CODIS, the DNA database, when they submit the missing persons report and then start matching DNA. And that's exactly how it can happen.
And have you got any examples of that happening with your work specifically?
Oh, gosh, yes. I mean, if I had gone through any length of time without getting quote unquote hit, I don't want to do harm. But I remember the first hit was what you would essentially call a quote unquote perfect hit, is that I did the sculpture. It was on the news. These things need to be seen. It does no good. There's so many times, you know, they just get stuck in a drawer. But there's actually a news broadcast, and a couple was sitting on the couch, and wife said to the husband that it could be your sister. And, you know, because they had, like, this is where she was found. And, you know, she had maybe a broken left arm when she was younger. There's other information. But seeing that image on the screen, that's what gets people to look. And that's all we need. All we need is somebody is to stop and pay attention and consider. And so he called the police and said, I think I know who this is. This could be my sister. DNA, it was a hit.
Wow.
And I nearly lost my mind. It wasn't like, it was validation. It was like, okay, I'm doing this right. You know, that it's working. And I just want to point out too, that we all always work with a forensic anthropologist.
Okay. Tell us a bit about what a forensic anthropologist, what their role would be and how that influences what you do.
Because they determine the age, sex, ancestry. I'm just missed one, but so we can't begin to start working on a skull unless we know, okay, this is a female who possibly in her 30s, European descent, things like that. And then they also measure the skull, and they'll notice things that need to be brought out in the sculpture, like maybe their nose had been broken in the past. So that would be something I would really need to highlight and even emphasize. If one of the big things for identification is unusual teeth. So say they have a gap in their front teeth. Whenever you see a sculpture smiling, look at the teeth, because the artist is showing the teeth for a reason.
Wow.
That can be a big thing. Dentists have said, that's my patient. I mean, that has happened. Yeah, so typically we do them with their mouth closed because we want them to be a neutral expression, because they can be matched to, like, say, a driver's license photo or something like that, or a missing person's, you know, photo. So that's why we keep them neutral. You know, there's no fancy, you know, expressive views or anything mm-hmm. like that. They're because they're a forensic purpose, you know. Like I said, it's not the time for artsiness.
And how accurate can you get it? How do you build up that face, you know, from a skull and making it look like you and me, a human being, with accuracy? I imagine you've got to know where the different muscles are. It's not just putting clay on top of the skull, like slapping it on, and then you'll get a replica of that face. Explain to us in a bit more detail about that. To you, it's the most obvious thing in the world, but to us, I don't see why you couldn't just cover a skull with some paper mache and be like, well, this is what they look like.
Right. Yeah. There have been a number of tissue depth studies. So we know, like, if you feel the skin on your forehead, you can go, okay, well, that's only about, you know, a few millimeters thick. And, you know, cheeks, obviously you have the fat pad, there. So we have averages of, like, say, along the back of the jawline. I still remember the averages is like 17 millimeters, you know, 5 to 6 millimeters for the forehead. And we don't know weight because these are all skeletal remains. 99% of them are skeletal. So we usually have to depict them at an average weight. But the more unusual the skull is, the more unique the sculpture is going to be. Like, there was a time when I had like 5 average male skulls in a row, and I started worrying, like, are these looking the same? Uh-huh. And I compared, you know, I went back and it's like, no, they're all different. They're all different. But, you know, there's plenty of average looking people. So if a skull came in with like a really high forehead, and that we know that because of the position of the eyes, somebody has a high forehead, that starts with the skull. So if we got, you know, a high forehead and a large nose and a protruding chin, I mean, that's just every forensic artist's dream, because that's going to be a really unique face. And so in those cases, they're never going to be a portrait. But they don't have to be. I mean, if we could, if some technology existed where we could make it into a portrait, you know, we would. But there's only so much you can determine from the skull. So we're working with all that we have. And other things is that, like, I had one case where there was a really good resemblance. It was sort of like an average, like, 30-year-old male. But in my sculpture, he had a straight nose. And he actually had a really, really crooked nose in life. Well, what had happened was that those nasal bones were gone. When we got the skull, they had been, you know, there's rodents, there's animal activity. So without those bones, the nasal bones, like right at the, you know, in between your eyes, like
the
that's
bridge there, yeah.
Before you get to the cartilage, the bridge there, that gives us a lot of information. So I didn't have that. So the only choice I had was to give him a straight nose.
Yeah.
So that's the other thing with our job, is to educate the public that, you know, there's some things we can determine and some we can't. And then you have to consider what we have to work with. I've had skulls where there was no jaw, there was no mandible. And you just have to do the best you can with half a skull, basically.
Wow.
But we've had identification.
And then what about adding finishing details like color or makeup or, you know, something like that, hair, do your sculptures take on a more lifelike, you know, like a Madame Tussauds kind of lifelike feel about them, or do they remain a neutral color?
At the FBI, they're always neutral. Some artists have different opinions. They're like, oh, they were, you know, they said brown hair, so they'll put a brown wig on or whatever. But if you start introducing color, you'd have to know that information, and you're not going to know that from skeletal remains. I mean, there's some just absolutely beautiful forensic sculptures out there using color. But at the FBI, it's like, no, we are only going to show what we know. And if you look at a sculpture of Lincoln or George Washington, you don't need color to know who that is.
Mm-hmm.
So color, and it can throw people off. I had one where you might think an inclination because she was Latina, oh, I'm going to give her dark hair and dark eyes. Well, no, because if I do that, like, you don't know. My hair color's changed I don't know how many times in the past year. So color, you know, if you're looking for a blonde, blue-eyed sister and an artist has put a brown wig on, you could just, you know, you've seen it and your mind just says no, that it doesn't register as a possibility.
So it's so too much of a risk, like a distraction.
Yeah.
A risk of distraction.
Exactly. And that goes in with, it's not ego, but it's just making it look like a more attractive sculpture and making it look better, you know, with wigs and makeup and things like that, or skin tone. I mean, you can't determine skin tone. And so it's just, and I'll tell you this, and maybe this will be a plea to the public, is that when you see something like that, there are people that have taken my sculptures, my drawings, other artists, and colorized them and publicized them. And they think they're helping, like, oh, no, like, we need to make this look better. And, you know,
you're like, I thought of that.
It's like we know that, you know, like,
yeah.
You know, we do have a forensic anthropologist. We do have people that know their jobs and know what they're doing. And please don't add color. But, you know, we can't help it. They're, you know, free country. They can do it. And I like to think their hearts are in the right place, but it's not benefiting anybody. And I've seen the results of that. I've seen my neutral colored sculpture be colorized with red hair, and guess what? Person was identified and she had blonde hair.
It's more frustrating than it is helpful, and you've got your reasons for doing things way you are. Absolutely. And how often have you sort of deconstructed the work that you do? You know, you're looking at somebody with a full face, and you're imagining their skull behind it. Do you think that you can accurately see the skull inside someone's head? Can you see mine right now?
It's every forensic artist does it. And I actually have a model of my own skull. I went to the dentist. They did one of those, you know, crazy fancy x-rays. And when he pulled it up on screen, I saw that it was my skull. I saw it wasn't just my teeth. I said, you have like a DICOM scan? Are you kidding me? And that, so the dentist was geeked out that I, with my job. And so he gave me the file on the thumb drive, and I had a copy of it printed. So I've got it in my art room. I have a copy of my skull, and it looks like how I thought it would look. It really does. There's nothing remarkable going on there. I'm just like average. But some of the things I've noticed over the years, and in working on a project with the Body Farm where we had skulls and life photos, you have the cheekbone.
Yeah.
You have like a nice strong cheekbone, just you can tell from the structure of your face. And other people that maybe have this, the zygomatic bone, other people's where it's thinner, maybe a little bit concave, they're going to be more sunken there. Their skin will fold differently. Mm. So things like that, every forensic artist is walking around with like x-ray vision, studying people.
Well, I like that. I'll take that compliment that you like my skull. Very kind of you. It's my favorite compliment for a Friday that I've ever had.
You have good bone structure. No. Yeah, people pay money to get nice plump cheeks, you know.
Thank you very much. Oh, stop with the skull compliments. Well,
please. Like I have close set eyes. Well, that's because the orbits on my skull are close set. It's not like my eyes are, you know, placed weird in the sockets. I mean, that starts with the skull. So, yeah, that would be another thing. If, you know, you see a skull in the sock, you know, the eye orbits are really far apart, you just kind of go, oh boy, because that's just a really good identifier.
Is that really helping build those unique features of the face? And I just want to ask you a bit about technology, because you've mentioned it earlier on, and I'd like to know how technology has evolved since you were working with the FBI during your career, the sorts of things that became available, and also perhaps, you know, things that you predict might become available in the future, or things that you'd like to see become available to help, that would have helped if they existed in your career.
Well, frankly, in order to solve the unidentifieds, the best thing has been the genetic genealogy, because that cuts out the middleman of, you know, that cousin going, I haven't seen, you know, Bob in 10 years or whatever. So the genetic genealogy, where they can build the family tree, if they can do that, then they can get the, you know, the pool of possibilities and really negate the need for a forensic artist. I mean, I would be fine if my job, if I were still at the FBI, if my job was no longer necessary because people were identified sooner, then great. Then, you know, some jobs just become obsolete. I don't think there's not as much, probably funding and the infrastructure to have genetic genealogy be, you know, one of the first go-tos with unidentified remains. You know, but if there were, if, I don't know, if somebody in the government decided, hey, let's make this a priority, these are most often, not all the times, homicide victims. You know, it's not like, you know, I mean, there's killers, plural, out there. So solving these cases is really important. So genetic genealogy is the big thing, and as far as the facial approximation goes, I mean, you know, there are databases out there, like, you know, my sculptures, you know, forensic artist sculptures would go on a government database, and that's how people could look up and look at the photos and everything. But if you can just cut that step out, I mean, that would be great. So
yeah, absolutely. Do you know, I'm surprised with that answer there. It's a really good answer, and one that I wasn't expecting. So thanks for that. And just finally, just onto a bit about your book, Clay and Bones, My Life as an FBI Forensic Artist. How does it read? Are you talking about cases? Is it your career? Is it the art? A bit of everything? Tell us about it.
Well, I'll tell you what, I never, ever intended to write a book, swore I never saw a reason for it. But it is mostly about, I'll say, like, three quarters. It's about the job of forensic artists, like, you know, how I got in and what it's like to work with skulls and some of the cases that I worked on. Unfortunately, I had a very bad experience with sexual discrimination and harassment. And that is sort of what tipped me into writing the book, because there was, it was a really, really bad situation that I was stuck in. And I couldn't, sometimes, you know, you can't leave a job. There was nowhere else for me to go. So I just felt it was really important that, yes, even at the FBI, sorry, things aren't always fair. And I just felt it was really important to tell my story, to say, this is what happened.
Okay, so yeah, is it almost a borderline a whistleblower book?
Yeah, because, you know, some things were said that it's like, no, I worked very hard for my career and my reputation. And, you know, I don't want that smeared. So it's, you know, it's in the book. If that bothers anybody, I know some people have said, oh, that would be triggering, or they only want to hear about the cool cases. It's like, well, I would have liked to have only worked cool cases and not have had that experience, but I did. And so what do you do when you can't or won't leave the job that you love? There's literally nowhere else for me to go to be a forensic artist and do facial approximation. I mean,
It's a very, very specific skill set that you have worked through, worked with up the years, and you can't take it to many places. Yeah, I understand that. Yeah, and also what comes across is that you're clearly very passionate and very knowledgeable, very, very knowledgeable about what you do. So I'm very sorry to hear that you had a negative experience in the workplace. And yeah, I'm sure that will help when it's in the book. It might be there to help other people as well, and people get an extra detail out of that story. So, you know, well done you for putting it out there.
Thank you.
We're going to wrap it up now. Is there anything else you'd like to say about the book, like what you'd like people to get out of it if they read it, or who would you say that it's specifically for?
I would say mostly women are into forensics. So, but people that there's a number of books out there, like say by medical examiners or people who work in death industries. So I don't know if you've heard of the book Stiff by Mary Roach. That's a classic about how cadavers are used in science. And Working Stiff is about a medical examiner. Smoke It's in Your Eyes is written by Kate and Dowdy, who was a worked in a mortician's office. So anybody that's interested in the inner workings of those kind of odd fields, with a crossover into a CSI, because, you know, that was my job. You know, I didn't carry a gun, but that was my job, is doing that work. So people that like those kind of books, I think would like mine.
Absolutely. Well, thank you so much, Lisa. It's been a real pleasure talking to you today. That book is called Clay and Bones, My Life as an FBI Forensic Artist. I'm sure you can pop it into Google, but it can also be found on the Talk Radio Europe bookshop. And on that note, we'll say goodbye to Lisa. Bye. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Here for the Lowe's early Black Friday deals? You're right on time for some of our biggest savings. We're talking up to 50% off select major appliances, plus up to an extra 25% off when you bundle select major appliances. Holiday lights going up soon? Select ladders are up to 50% off right now. Get Black Friday prices without the Black Friday crowds. Lowe's, we help you save. Valid through 11/19. Selection varies by location. Select locations only. While supplies last. See Lowe's.com for more details.